Hi, I'm Sharon Barker, alcoholic. Oh, okay, since you're doing it up here, my sobriety date is August 20th, 1975. And that's nothing in this room, I know. Well, thank you, Lenny. He picked me up at the airport, and he's got 3 years more than me, so I sat in the back seat, so... Actually, his wife had, Dale and I was in the front seat, and she was being really quiet, and he was kind of, you know, he was talking and driving, and sometimes that's a bad combination when you're in the back seat and they're trying to make a point as, you know, they're turning around. And but so I thought, well, she's, you know, she's up there praying, and then I realized she was being real quiet, and she was sleeping. It's the way you deal with this sometimes, you just go to sleep. So anyway, it's great to be here, and thank you, Lenny. Lenny's a talker. I really enjoyed him. But the thing that I that he also renewed my hope again, and people that are down the road, old timers older than me, is that they're good listeners. He's a good listener, and I really I appreciate that. I appreciate that. You know, it was has been said we all have a story, and everybody has their own special gift to give. So. I don't know if you know what yours is yet, but stick around. I mean, Jay talked about dreams, and Casey talked about the circles closing and healing happening, and Juanita talked about change, and people can change. And, you know, I know my friend Mildred's going to, you know, teach me something, because she always does just by her smile. And being here with Ken again after many, many years, it's great to see him, and Rick again, and meet Steve. And I'm going to learn something from each one of those people that stand at a podium and share. And I'm going to learn. I've already learned so much from just walking around and being with you. It's been a joy. And I'm a sponge. I like to soak it up. I was a spiritual seeker long before I ever knew I was a spiritual seeker. I just know the spirits of alcohol made me feel like I had already found nirvana. So it was temporarily put on hold as alcohol was working, and it's nice to see my friends Jack and Leslie here, too. And thank you, Harlan. Thanks, Sylvia, for a great bunch you put together to put this on. Not a trick has been missed, and you know how we are. Always looking for the loopholes. But not here, you know, not here. There's some spirit here. There's some energy here. There's we absolutely insist. Is that alcoholic? Absolutely. And insist. You know, I'm living and enjoying life, and my world is bigger because I am with you. My fire burns brighter because you've helped me take the little ember of life that walked in here just barely, barely burning. Barely, barely burning, and you didn't snuff it out. You helped me kindle it, and, you know, we blew on it, and we fanned it, and we fed it your kindling, and, you know, put some twigs in, and made it grow so that I burn brightly today, because I'm an example of this wonderful fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I am. I'm, you know, all God wants you to do to lead a spiritual, sober life is to brighten the corner where you are. So I hope wherever you are, you're brightening the corner. I hope if, you know, you walk away from this weekend, if you're bored, maybe you're boring, and you can tell that, and you can get going. Get going. There's a lot to do. Alcoholics are dying every day of this disease. You know, and as Casey said, if they're still breathing, there's hope. But the examples of Alcoholics Anonymous speak so loudly, I can't hear a word they're saying sometimes. And I watch. I'm one of those that I'll, you know, okay, you know, where are you going to trip up? Where are you telling me another lie? It's not really true. And you know, I've learned so much here, and I feel like I'm just beginning. I feel like I'm 55 years old. If I stay sober August, I'll have 30 years. I feel like I'm just beginning. I feel so alive and in love with life because every day I wake up with hope. Every single day, that is something. Hope went out of my... I don't know about you, but I'm a bar drinker. I love those bars and the... You know, the darker and the seedier and, you know, one of my favorite in the French Quarter, we painted the windows black so not even an ounce of sunlight could come in there. Ounce of sunlight. But at one point in my drinking, Hope got up and walked out of the bar. Hope that had been with me since I was a little girl got up and walked out. And once that happened, alcoholism became a different animal in my life. And I hope I never forget. I hope I never forget. I hope I can see it in your eyes, watch you come alive, because Don P. was mentioned, Don Pritz was mentioned, and he too made an impact on my life and my son's life. My son would get calm around him when he was small and, you know, a little nervous, and how boys are. He would get calm around him and be able to color him pictures, and there was just a calmness about him. And Don told me this story once. I just love this story because this is what it, you know, I hope I never forget. I hope I never forget and what it's like to, you know, to look at my shoes and to not have any worth and to not be able to look in the mirror and to feel like I'm just, please let me evaporate. I am not worth a thing. And if you knew what you had in the room with you, you wouldn't even want to talk to me. And that's the way I felt when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have the privilege and the joy of watching the light go on in the people's lives around me. And not just the new people, but people that are hurting, people that are having a hard time. You know, the light comes back on and I go, yes. I get to stand right next to that hope. I get to stand right next to it, to them, and watch the miracle come alive in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's an inside job. The light switches on the inside, and only you can turn it on. We can kind of guide you in the direction and lay those spiritual tools at your feet, but you got to work them. We can't do it for you. But I get to sit right next to it because I'm involved in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Don told the story of a little boy who was the only boy in his family, and his parents told him one day, you know, you're going to have a little brother or sister. So this little boy got obsessed, you know, okay, when the baby comes, I got to talk to that baby. And, you know, when that baby comes, I got to have a moment alone, you know. And so this little boy was insistent about his new sibling that was coming into the world, and they were a little concerned, like, well, what's he going to do? Is he jealous? What's going on? And so the little baby came home, and the parents saying, oh, let's just monitor him, kind of stay around him. And so they always did, and the little boy would always, like, kind of wait for the parents to go away, and they just kind of hung around. And then, you know, one day when the baby was, I don't know, 3 or 4 months old, the little boy saw that his parents were taking a nap, and so he snuck down the hall and quietly opened the door and quietly went in there, and the parents heard him. And so they thought, well, let's just stand at the door and listen. And the little boy went up to his little baby brother, and he said, quick, tell me about God. I'm starting to forget. And it's you know, it's working with the new people, working with people that are walking in the doors. I don't want to forget. I want to see it. I want to remember how much fun I had at the end of my drinking. You know, what it was like to have a blown gallbladder and a pancreatitis and splotches on my cheeks and 175 pounds and a red dashiki and a Panama hat and a backpack with a book in it called Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass. And I... And my quarter Jose in there, and you know, and just bloated and toxic and unemployable and unbathed and a dark, dark, dark spirit when I came to you. I don't ever want to forget. So I hope that I always have a chance of watching the newcomer walk in the door, and watching the light go on, because it renews me. It flames my flame. It flames my fire. And if you need a log, you grab one of mine tonight. You take my log and you make your fire burn brighter, and you find out what your gift is and you give it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's your only special little gift. Each one of us have one. And I was looking for purpose my whole life. I was seeking something my whole life. And alcohol helped me just kind of take a breath. Alcohol helped me not to worry about, you know, I'm a little girl in Iowa, and I am obsessed with Gandhi. I am, you know, I'm sitting around the table where we grow the food, make the food, and I don't want to eat, you know, because it's about, you know, peaceful resistance. And they would just, oh, get over it. Eat your mashed potatoes. Don't worry about Gandhi. You know, he'll be okay. And you know, I'm a little girl looking for the mothership and sitting out in the soybean fields going, here I am, Iowa, come get me. You dropped me off at the wrong spot. you know, and Gandhi says we must become the change that we wish to see. And I never knew that. It was always the grass is greener. It's got to be over there. And I wanted the diploma without having to do the work. And I wanted to go A to Z. I don't want to go through all the steps. I don't want to grow up. I don't want to go have 2.5 children and a two-car garage and a pig farm. I mean, I feel like a pig. Now, do I want to have a pig farm? I mean, Iowa was that was my first resentment and the last place I wanted to be, even as a little girl. Even as a little girl. But I was one of those. I come from a non-alcoholic family. I'm still it. I am the only one yet. And I confuse those people. They are very, very confused by me. Even today when I go home, the party starts. You know, they can always count on a full house of people and a lot going on when I come home. But at least my quality of friends, which are you guys, are a lot better than what I used to drag home. I remember dragging home. Well, you know, my parents and I, we started to have a parting of the ways when I went off to college. It was the 60s. It wasn't just say no. It was just say thanks. So we would find truth on 16 four-way hits of Sunshine or something, you know, and drinking my wine or whatever I was drinking. I always drank. I mean, I drank a lot from the first time I had my Canadian club in Schlitz beer. From the very first time, I drank a lot. I had a big capacity. I could drive everybody home. I could keep the party going. But I started to have a falling out with my parents when I went to this university because I would start to have discussions with them about, you know, their lifestyle and what I thought that how they should maybe try to change. And my father and I would have these arguments. It was always, you know, I was always argumentative with my dad. And I would always goad him into something and so I could, you know, jump up from the table or get up from the living room and go, you don't understand and you'll never understand. It was always very dramatic and always very much about me. But, you know, I came home and I woke him up and it was cold. I remember there was some frost on the ground and I made him sit at the kitchen table and I wanted to talk to them. And so they get up and they're sitting there and, you know, they live in a small town miles and then even in the country. I mean, you know, it's a small little community. And my dad and mom get up and they sit at the table and I said, I have to tell you something. And I blurted out that, you know, we're not going to be mom and dad, you're going to be Margin Frank and I'm not Sharon anymore. That's a corny name and I'm going to be called Cher. So, yeah. At first my mother was pleased that I hadn't eloped with this thing I drug home with no shoes and eyes spinning in his head. She was pleased that that wasn't what I was going to be telling them. And I said, it's not like Sonny and Cher, it's Cher and Cher alike, Share, because by God, that's the way I'm going to live my life. I'm going to share everything. And, you know, my dad just set his jaw and went to bed, and my mother, oh, Sharon, you know, and got up. And what? I'm trying to talk to you. I'm trying to share with you. You want me to communicate with you? What? Why? You never listen to me, and I know I'm the middle of three girls, and I have a younger brother, and everybody's fine. But I was the defiant one. I was the one that wanted to pull you into an argument. I was the one that wanted to shake my fist and have a reason to stomp off, have a reason to be mad at the world, because I'm already mad. I don't know why I'm angry, but I'm mad. I had my heart broken, but all right. I drank over that. I didn't cry over that. That was okay. I got over that. But I'm just pissed off. I don't know why. Just mad. And my dad, I had a suicide attempt. My father came down to talk to me with the family priest. The priest and I got drunk. You know, my dad was speechless. He went back home. They caught me on the evening news disrupting a courtroom. You know, isn't that Sharon? You know, and so my father tried to talk to me, and all I would do was pull him in, let him see the pain, and then back him off. You know, my dad had the big shoulders, and I would lay it out there to let him know, I need some help here. I'm a little scared. I don't know what's going on with life. I don't know what direction to take. And then when he would try to help me, I would back him off with my anger and my mouth and my defiance. And he would just have no recourse but to walk away from me. And I didn't know. I didn't know I was setting it up. You know, my dad was first, and then there was God. You know, I got mad at God at a church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and I got the priest so pissed off that he came out of the confessional at me. And I was able to shake my fist, justify it, and leave God there. And I mean, I love, when I was a little girl, I loved confession because I'd walk out of there and I'd think, okay, if I just do these five Hail Marys, my brown little soul would get white again, you know, and then I can go out tonight with the boys from Iowa City and, you know, dance to the Righteous Brothers and that V-neck sweater and English leather and bourbon, that smell of bourbon. Okay, I'll dance with this one. Yeah, he's got the bourbon in his car. That's why I dance close with the boys, is to smell them and find out who had booze, you know. And this was before I could drive. My parents would drop me off and come by and pick me up, and I would lie in the back seat and pass out, and they just thought I was tired from dancing, you know. So life was good. I mean, really, I didn't have a lot of problems, but I'm mad. I'm mad, and then I get really mad, and then my dad and I have a big fight, and then he says he's not paying for college anymore if I'm just going to party and waste his money. And so it was another reason to shake my fist, and basically my bags were packed and said, you know, go about your way, go make a living. We don't know what to do with you anymore. And I had been to psychiatrists, and I had been to the family doctor, and they gave me the Valium therapy, and it didn't work. And the psychiatrist, if you cross your legs and cross your arms and you don't talk to them, they can't get very far with you. So it was a waste of their money, and they didn't go back a couple of times. That was it. And so I started taking my geographics, and I always thought the grass was greener, and I found out why the grass was greener. It was a piece of truth I was seeking, always seeking. Why is the grass greener? Why? It always feels that way. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A speaker named Norm Alpe said, the reason the grass was greener is because the other guy took care of his lawn. I was like, okay. And then he said, and if you're new, and he seemed to look right at me, he said, we know what you're made of, a lot of good fertilizer. And that will make a really good lawn. But you got to hang in there with us. We got to till it under and make it happen. And, you know, I love the old timers because they don't give you truth without hope. I mean, they don't give you dark raving truth without some sort of a process to get through that so that, you know, you can accept it and heal and face it and grow. And that's just the way I've been led through Alcoholics Anonymous. And my job is to stay willing. My job is to stay open. My job is to say yes to life, say yes to AA, to say yes to that deep voice, that great fact deep within me that guides me and loves me and takes care of me. And I never, ever, I just poured alcohol on that voice. I poured alcohol on it because it was a conscience. It told me what I was doing wasn't the way I was raised. It told me what I was doing wasn't being part of the force for good in the world. It told me what I was doing was hurting people and tearing out their hearts and breaking their hearts. And it told me I was a loser sometimes. I didn't want to hear that voice. I poured alcohol on it. Alcohol worked for me. And I'm taking my geographics, and I try to go back to art school, and I try to paint, and I can't anymore, and I don't know what happened. I lived in New York for a while. Maybe the bartender in one of my blackouts said, you got to pay with your art talent now. If you're going to go down the road of alcoholism, you got to pay with your art talent. And I know what I would have said. If I would have been conscious for that conversation, I would have said, take my art talent. Who cares? Give me my alcohol. But somewhere along the line, that left me. Somewhere along the line, I came through Colorado. I couldn't paint anymore. I went to school and it was over. I was sad and depressed and I ended up in Colorado. Somewhere along the line in Colorado, maybe I was in a blackout and I didn't catch it. The bartender asked for my dignity. Why do I need dignity? I don't care about dignity. Take my dignity. Fill up my glass and buy him one too. I don't care. Just take my dignity. I want my alcohol. And I don't know, I came to California for the first time when I was 20 years old. I turned 21. I had met Bob Dylan in Colorado. I think it was Bob, I'm not really sure, but looked like him, sang like him. And I ended up turning 21 on the corner of Westwood Boulevard in front of the Bank of America building, panhandling for my wine. Free. Backpack on. Booking it. Be here now. Some guy bought me two bottles of wine. I drank them, and I went over, and the Krishnas were dancing there in front of the Bank of America building. And we all maybe had a few encounters, but I liked what was going on that night, and I kind of got into it with them, and you know, dancing with them and hanging out. And And so they thought it was very karmic. It was my 21st birthday. And see, everybody always saw the brown aura, the hole in my psyche. I mean, these people that had a sense of spirit could spot me way in the corner. There's a dark one. She needs help. And any time that they would, and I liked what they had. They had a spirit. I mean, the ones baptizing you in Laguna Beach and in the Pacific Ocean had a sense of spirit. There was a community there. And I would kind of vibrate towards those people. But as soon as they wanted eternity, forever, or a commitment, I live a day at a time. Do you see this backpack? Say this book. I'm in the now. I can't make a commitment to you guys. I'll go get some more wine and have my birthday alone. Thank you. And that's what I did. And I ended up back in Colorado where I went to my old place to get my things back, and something else had changed in there. A lot of my worth had run out my sleeve. And I asked the guy who answered the door, I said, I used to live here. He answered the door in my favorite dashiki and my favorite coffee, porcelain coffee mug. And I thought, okay, those are my clothes, those are my dishes, those are my towels, those are my sheets, those are my pictures on the wall. And I said to him, there's a box of photographs in the corner. I used to live here. I'd like them back. He said, sure, come on in. Get your photographs. And I remember getting the box and the screen door slamming behind me, and I thought, turn around and go get your things. Go pack your things up. Ask for your things back. They're yours. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And I thought, what's wrong with you? And I went to the Mountain Man Bar, and I got drunk and ended up hitching a ride on a mail truck where the rod went through the engine about somewhere in Nebraska, and I hitchhiked the rest of the way home, and I'm back with Mom and Dad. I'm 21, and my mother said, you can stay in this house for a little while till you start to feel better, but please stay out of your father's way. You break his heart, and don't take any drugs in this house. Fine. And I had my new dog with me they had given me in California at this commune I kind of hung at for a while, and so me and my dog lived upstairs, and I drank a lot. And I would go into those taverns in that small town in Iowa, and I would sit in there and judge you guys. Look at that guy from high school. I knew he'd be in here every night. I'm in there every night. I'm not getting it. I'm sitting at the end of the bar growling at everybody, judging everybody. Me and my dog are growling at everybody. And my dog got killed, and I didn't... It was January, and my heart was broken, and I put her in the trunk of the car. She got hit by a truck or a bus, I can't remember. And she was dead in the trunk of my car, frozen. And my mother, probably wondered where that dog was. But one night, and it was her car. One night I'm sitting there, I don't know, left the bars closed at 2, and I'm crying, and I've got the little tar baby. It was kind of covered in a blankie, and I had the blankie, and I'm crying and talking and petting my dead dog that's frozen because it's Iowa, January. And my mother comes out and was like, oh, horrified, horrified. How long has that dog been in the trunk? How come you didn't tell me? Why don't we bury it? She got some shovels out and moved that frozen earth, though, I'll tell you. And but that was my only friend, and my heart was broken. And so I was sitting in that bar judging everybody again one day, and in walks in somebody I'd known, and I was ready for this. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty independent, and I'm pretty tough, and I don't need anybody, but it was one of those nights. I must have been drinking gin, because if I'm drinking gin and listening to Ray Price sing For the Good Times over and over and over again, crying on my lap, tears, crocodile tears. But somebody said, let me take care of you. And it was like, okay, you can take care of me now. I'm tired. If it would have been one day before, one day after, if I was drinking tequila, get out of my way. But he got me on a good night, and I said, okay. So I packed up my things and moved up to northern Wisconsin, which was another geographic, and I didn't know these people were all organic. And I didn't know these people were going to take away my cigarettes and my booze. And I didn't know this community of people were they were just going to smoke organic stuff from morning to night, morning to night, morning to night. And I rode these big Esmeraldas and tried to get some relief on it, and the snow would be falling, and I'd know that, oh, they're playing that Hootenanny music again, And I got another dog, didn't hear about the last one, and the dog's there looking at me. I'm in my rocking chair trying to just get some relief from this Esmeralda. And the snow looks like it's going to keep going, and he missed that fifth string on that banjo one more time. And the cat's flicking its tail, and the dog is looking at me like, God, do something. And I'm rocking and reading my Mother Earth news, and it's not even a TV, you know. It's like we're waiting for the wheat grinder to come in the mail so we can make our own bread from organic wheat berries, and work, work, work. And I'm not getting any relief. None. You know? And they put that Pete Seeger record on one more time. And I flew out of that chair into my bald-tired station wagon with a big sun painted on the hood named Cheshire. You got to name those cars. They last longer if you name those cars. Had a big grill, looked like a Cheshire grin. So I named me and Cheshire went to the general store. And I got my quarters together because I painted mailboxes. That's how I earned my money. I put my quarters down, and I got 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I felt better. I felt better. I came back and put the wine on the table, and the cat looks calmer, and the dog's smiling at me, and they're all looking at me, you know. They're giving me already that kind of evil-eyed look, you know. I used to think it was the Al-Anon squinty-eyed look, you know, but I've come to find out it's that look like, oh, my God, here you go. You're going to make a fool of yourself again, you know, because they're sober watching us. But all these people, they didn't drink. They didn't drink. So I got roaring drunk that night. I kicked their records around. I had a great time. I cranked up my rock and roll. I opened the door and let the snow hit me in the face and drinking my wine. And they all woke up about 2 in the morning because I was probably making a lot of noise. And they all kind of peeked around the corner at me, like, what's she doing now? What are we supposed to do with this one? And I took it like it's judgment. They're judging me. I don't care for these people at all. They're not my people. And my head, I don't know about you, but my head talks to me. You know, my head, it'll say something really good right before I go in a blackout that I'll remember. You know, it's and my head said, alcohol is more fun than you. And I don't need you. And eventually, I kind of drove them out. Well, they all went and did primal therapy, and I didn't want to spend any money on that. And I just got drunk and yelled at the sheep. We had 50 head of organic sheep. So I'd scream at the sheep from the hayloft with my bottles of wine, having my own primals. And but they had left me with this half acre of marijuana they had planted, this organic crop. And I was happy with that. All I do is go out there and weed the patch every day and pluck back the tops to make it bush, and me and the cat and the dog and the horse, and that was my summer. And my friend Clarence the farmer had come. He was my only buddy, and he would bring the wild turkey at night, and I'd hear that tractor round in the lane, and I knew the wild turkey was coming. And the reason that Clarence was on a tractor, he had too many DWIs, they pulled his license. So, and some nights he put in his teeth, and some nights he wouldn't put in his teeth. So, oh, you've done it. Stop it. Some of you don't even have teeth. Come on. So, I don't know. His wife took away the keys to the tractor. I never saw him again. And I harvested that stuff by horseback, looking for low-flying planes for 3 days, you know, drinking my wine and eating the salad of, you know, bud. And because nothing goes to waste. Nothing. And I went into town to this big dope deal. I was going to sell it all and leave. And it was 45 miles into Menominee, Wisconsin. And I forgot the dope. I left it back on the farm. And I looked at my dog. My dog looked at me. We forgot, you know. And so I don't know about you, but I make these really good instant decisions about life. And there was a carnival there. And I thought, I always wanted to be a gypsy. Let's go on over and check it out. And actually, my audition was to go shot for shot with the owner of the show, Matt Armstrong. And I was still standing at the end of that bottle of tequila, and he said, pack some stuff up. I'll give you a shooting gallery. I'll give you a joint, they called it, and come join up. We'll see you tomorrow. There's an opening, and you pass the test. So I packed up some clothes, you know, a lot of hefty bags full of green stuff, and told my dog to get in, and off we went, joining the carnival. And I left I left that place. I just left everything the way it was. I didn't feed the sheep. I didn't take care of the horse. The cat didn't want to come, so I just left. And I thought, okay, I love this lifestyle. You're in town for 2 or 3 days, and you leave your mess all behind you, and you just keep on rolling. You just keep on rolling. They drink like I drink. I've got this green stuff to switch them out with some stuff to keep me awake so I don't miss truth if it happens. And we travel a lot in the middle of the night anyway, and everybody's best friends for a moment, as long as we have something we need from each other. And it worked for me, and I called my mother from Arkansas. Now, she thinks I'm in Wisconsin, going to maybe marry this guy, have these 85 acres of organic land that we bought. She thinks I'm up there. You know, I made maple syrup for them at Christmas one year. We put a little label on it and everything. We tapped those maple trees and work, work, work. And so I call my mom from Arkansas, and she starts to cry. I was like, Mom, come on. My mom was always my biggest hero. My mom was always right there for me. We were always close. And Mom started to cry. I was like, come on, Mom. It's just another chapter in my book. Come on. Why do you have to cry? And she just couldn't believe I had done that. And my mother, you know, it's all about me. I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. And that's the biggest lie we can tell ourselves. Alcoholism, they say, the Al-Anon say, and I believe this, and I bet it's more, that when an alcoholic takes a drink, 10 people are immediately affected. And I'm sure it's more. I'm sure it's more. So that, but it was all about me. I'm not hurting anyone but me. Mom, leave me alone. But each one of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, in life, in sobriety, we weave this beautiful tapestry of who we are in here tonight, of what we're about tonight. And if one of those threads is pulled, the tapestry is a little less brilliant until we find somebody else to put a thread in there to make that sun a little more brilliant that we're looking at. Together, we are such a beautiful, beautiful picture. And so it's not about me. My life today is not about me. My sobriety is not about me. It's about being an example. Yeah, it's about being willing. But it's about whatever I can bring to the world today, whatever I can do to help God's kids get things done today, whatever's in my path, whether you're sober or not, it's not my job to judge. Chuck C. said, it rains on the just and the unjust, and I heard him when he said that. It's not my job to judge. Whoever needs it, whoever's in front of me. It's my job just to help them get done what needs to get done. And sometimes it's not always my favorite person that needs something done, but if I'm there willing and my eyes are open, I help. Because together we make this beautiful tapestry. We need, you know, the dark clouds and the pretty sun. We need it all. We need it all. We all have a story to tell. We all have a thread that's brilliant, that makes the picture happen. But it's all, you know, Mom, I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. Why do you have to cry? So now I can't call home anymore. Mom's the only one I talk to. I call my sister, my one sister, because she sends me plane tickets and money. My brother would occasionally find me with his college buddies and see how I was doing. My one sister found me somewhere once. My younger sister gave me a ring to protect me. I went, why do I need to be protected? Why are you giving me this ring? I'm not hurting anyone but me. Leave me alone. Just let me go about my life. My mother had to get in that car and drive. It's got to be 5 hours from where she is to drive up there and get her antiques out of that house that she had given me. To drive up there and find the cat had been kicked by the horse and that needed to go to the vet and was just about dead. The cat did live. It retired with a little old lady in Iowa, and every time he saw me come, he'd go the other way. My mother had to drive up there a number of times, get the sheep, have somebody take care of the sheep, to find this guy to make sure that land was being sold or something, so that I wasn't liable. But I'm not hurting anyone. Me, Mom, it's just the carnival. Come on. It's another chapter in my book. Can't you just be happy for me for once? And, you know, I ended up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, busted for drugs, sales and possession, and they wouldn't get that it was just my stash. I had enough to make it. They thought I was selling. I was bartering. I wasn't selling. And But they knew where to find everything I had, hidden in the dog food. And They came in the morning with their shotguns, and I had to stand up without a sheet against the wall. And my new roommate had to stand up without a sheet against the wall. And he was happy he found me that night, I'll tell you. He was with the show, too, and he had a pet skunk. So the skunk went to jail. My dog went to jail. The two of us went to jail. We all went to jail. And the carnival left town. Nobody came by to see how I was, my new best friends. And they didn't give me my rights. They didn't read me my rights. I thought, okay, they didn't read me my rights. I'll get out now. So for 2 days, I screamed about my rights, and they finally typed them up and handed them to me through the bars, told me to shut up. Then I realized no one's coming back to get me, and then I'm realizing, too, something's funny starting to happen. They're starting to all talk about me all the time. And I'm starting to have auditory hallucinations. I didn't know I was having DTs. People's heads would get pointed, and you know, they'd turn into cone heads, and they were coming to get me. And so I would cut myself and put blood all around my bunk, and I was pretty crazy. And I wouldn't bathe because they all watched. You know, they were all there, and I was very paranoid. And they were coming to get me, but they left me alone because she's the crazy one, because I'm the alcoholic having DTs. Dodge that bullet. They did come get me and put cuffs on me one day and took me to a building and threw me in this room, and there sat my dad. And I didn't call my dad. My one phone call was to my brother-in-law, who was a lawyer in New York. But he got in touch with my dad. And my dad, even though my father and I couldn't sit down at the same breakfast table and eat together, couldn't ride in the same car because, God forbid, you could cut the pain between us with a knife. Nobody liked to be around it if my dad and I were sitting in the same room. And God forbid somebody would say something, and then off we would go again. It's like the Thanksgiving dinner that my grandmother sat me with the children because they were afraid of having me at the big table. They didn't know if I was going to have a cathartic crying over the turkey or, you know, if I was going to toss it at somebody. They just didn't know how I was going to act. They were very perplexed with what was happening with me. The little girl that could have been anything she wanted to be growing up. One with musical abilities and art talent and brought a smile to many people's faces and had little paintings hanging in my small town. My dad and I would walk by and he'd say, look, there's your painting in that restaurant. The one who played the accordion because her dad's Czech and I wanted to do something special for him. Corny. Playing an accordion wasn't cool. It's still not cool. But, you know, I'd ride down in those hay wagons in those small towns, and they have a celebration, and me and the Boddicker accordion band, and I'd have my big red dress on and that Titano mother of pearl black and white accordion, and my dad would be there, and I'd play so loud just for him. And then I'd go another block, and there were, oh, my God, there's the boys from last night. This is not cool. But I wanted to please my dad so much. And now you can't even sit us together at the same breakfast table. We can't walk down the hallway because we might brush shoulders. So one would wait and the other one would go. And there he sits in this lawyer's office. His daughter's thrown into a very, very sad southern jail with people not being nice to her. And I'm sure I looked awful. I looked horrible because I didn't bathe and I was crazy. And he hired this lawyer who took his money and tried to get me out with the bail bondsman who took his money. And I don't remember much of that day at all. And in my amends, because amends have been talked about a lot with the speakers, and I'm sure it's going to continue because a very, very powerful part of my story is making it right with my dad. It took years. You know, just don't waltz home after a year of sobriety. Let's open up a few wounds, Dad. Let's talk about this and that and tell me how it felt so I can say I'm sorry. You know, I mean, that's the way it would have been if I wouldn't have been guided through the amends with my sponsor and the people who have sponsored me. My amends continued a long time with my family. But I asked my dad when I was 20 years sober, I got permission, 20 years sober. I asked my dad if he remembered that day in Louisiana in Bogalusa in the lawyer's office. Well, of course he did. He had to get on a plane and change planes and pay for a plane ticket and fly into New Orleans and look at a map and rent a car and bring his checkbook. Of course he did. I said, tell me about that day if you can, Dad, because I don't remember much. I don't remember anything other than we didn't lock eyes because we hadn't locked eyes for years. And he said, well, the biggest part of that day was what you told me over and over again. It's not my fault. I'm not guilty. It's not my fault. And that's all I said to him. I didn't give him much to go on, did I?